Warren Buffett didn't become one of the world's wealthiest investors by accident. His decision to allocate nearly a third of his portfolio to banking stocks speaks volumes about the sector's potential. But what makes bank investing so compelling in today's rapidly evolving financial landscape? As fintech unicorns multiply, 58 of them collectively worth $213.5 billion, according to CB Insights, traditional banking faces an existential challenge. Yet this disruption creates extraordinary opportunities for investors who understand both the fundamentals of banking and the technological revolution reshaping the industry. Whether you're fascinated by Amazon's potential to match Wells Fargo's 70 million customer relationships in just 5 years, compared to Wells Fargo's 168-year journey, or intrigued by how smaller banks can compete against giants spending over $45 billion annually on technology, bank investing offers a uniquely rewarding playground for the informed investor. The balance sheet is the beating heart of any bank, driving earnings through a simple yet powerful mechanism. Interest-earning assets funded by interest-bearing liabilities with a thin equity cushion providing stability. This structure explains why banks operate with significantly higher leverage than other industries, typically 10 times debt to equity compared to the S&P 500's modest 1.5x. This leverage isn't reckless. It's necessary for banks to generate competitive returns on equity despite their relatively low returns on assets. Asset size carries particular significance in banking, with regulatory thresholds creating distinct operational environments. The $10 billion threshold is especially consequential, triggering the Durbin Amendment, reducing debit interchange fees, Volcker Rule, banning proprietary trading, and disqualification from using the simplified community bank leverage ratio. Banks approaching this threshold face a strategic dilemma: stall growth, leap over it via acquisition, or sell. Understanding these dynamics allows investors to anticipate multiple expansion or contraction by forecasting asset growth. Loans constitute the largest portion of bank assets, typically over 50%, and drive primary revenue. Loan growth, usually measured on a linked quarter annualized basis or year over year, serves as a key metric for investors. Banks with faster loan growth tend to command higher valuation premiums, though growth significantly exceeding industry averages might raise red flags about underwriting standards. Securities represent the second major category of interest-earning assets, averaging around 25% of assets for community banks. Unlike loans, these holdings prioritize liquidity and safety over yield, allowing banks to quickly convert them to cash when needed. Popular securities include agency-backed mortgage-backed securities, treasury securities, and non-taxable municipal bonds. Their classification as held to maturity, available for sale, or held for trading determines how gains and losses are recorded, with most community banks holding the majority as available for sale. On the liability side, deposits form the largest component and serve as the primary funding source for loans. The quality of a bank's deposit base significantly impacts its franchise value and competitive advantage through lower cost of capital. For example, First National Bank of Griffin's 2017 deposit cost of 27 basis points compared favorably to the industry average of 36 basis points, illustrating their funding advantage. Federal Home Loan Bank advances provide additional liquidity for lending operations, though typically at higher costs than deposits. Equity, though representing less than 10% of a bank's capital structure, serves as the critical loss-absorbing buffer protecting depositors. Finding the optimal balance is crucial. Too much equity results in subpar returns on equity, while too little limits growth potential and increases risk. Return on assets, ROA, for banks typically hovers in the low single digits, mathematically consistent with their net interest margins. This modest ROA is compensated for through leverage, enabling banks to deliver competitive returns to shareholders. Breaking down ROA by dividing each major income statement line by average assets helps identify profitability drivers, as seen with First National Bank of Griffin, which showed below peer ROA primarily due to lower fee income and higher taxes. Return on equity, ROE, equals ROA multiplied by financial leverage, with regulatory frameworks providing useful goalposts for estimating sustainable leverage levels. Return on tangible common equity, ROTCE, provides a more refined metric by adjusting for acquisition accounting artifacts like goodwill, improving comparability between banks with different acquisition histories. Net interest margin, NIM, represents net interest income divided by average earning assets and is one of banking's most critical metrics. In 2017, the median NIM for all U.S. banks was 3.58%, with the 75th percentile at 3.91%. Higher NIMs typically correlate with higher risk profiles, as demonstrated by the relationship between yield on assets and non-performing assets across the banking industry. The efficiency ratio, ER, calculated as non-interest expenses divided by net revenues, provides insight into a bank's operational discipline. Healthy banks typically maintain ratios in the 50 to 60% range, with exceptional performers achieving ratios in the 40s. Analysis shows a sweet spot for efficiency in the 10B to 50B asset range, with these banks averaging a 56.7% efficiency ratio compared to 73.1% for banks under 1B. Non-interest income to revenues represents the percentage of revenues derived from non-interest sources, with industry averages in the 20-30% range. Higher percentages generally indicate less interest rate sensitivity, though some fee revenues remain correlated with rate movements. Tangible common equity to tangible assets, TCE ratio, represents common equity less intangibles divided by total assets less intangibles, providing the clearest view of leverage from a common shareholder perspective. This metric helps reconcile ROA and ROTCE for valuation purposes and serves as a key indicator of a bank's ability to absorb losses. Asset quality represents the quantity and severity of existing and potential credit problems on a bank's balance sheet. Due to banks' highly leveraged nature, even seemingly small write-offs can have major financial implications. For investors, anticipating credit issues requires understanding economic trends affecting geographies, industries, and asset types, though credit issues may take time to manifest in financial statements. Banks use internal classification systems to categorize loans by risk of non-payment. Non-adversely classified loans include past loans, performing as underwritten, and special mention loans, potential weaknesses requiring management attention. Adversely classified loans include substandard, inadequately protected by borrower capacity or collateral, doubtful, collection highly questionable, and loss, essentially worthless assets. Key asset quality metrics include non-performing assets, NPAs, to assets, which averaged around 54 basis points industry-wide post-financial crisis. The loan loss reserves to loans ratio averaged around 1.25%, down from crisis peaks of approximately 3.65%. A larger loan loss reserve can temporarily boost earnings as it normalizes, while an unusually light reserve may drag on future expenses. The Texas ratio, developed by Jared Cassidy of RBC during the 1980s recession, is defined as NPAs over TCE plus LLR. As this ratio approaches 100%, bank failure likelihood increases since the denominator represents the buffer protecting depositors against loan losses. During the global financial crisis, about 500 banks had Texas ratios above 100%, compared to only 25 by Q2 2018. Credit concentrations create correlated exposures that can amplify losses during downturns. Regulators and investors focus on three key commercial real estate concentration metrics: total CRE, excluding owner-occupied, as percentage of risk-based capital, guideline 300%, construction and development loans as percentage of risk-based capital, guideline 100%, and CRE growth, guideline not exceeding 50% over 3 years. In 2016, the Financial Accounting Standards Board introduced the current expected credit loss model to replace existing methodologies, effective January 2020 for SEC filers with calendar fiscal years. This represents a fundamental shift in how banks account for credit losses, requiring allowance for lifetime losses on day one rather than waiting for losses to become probable. While this should theoretically reduce variance over loan life, the impact varies by portfolio duration and problem loan exposure. Capital serves as a cushion, allowing banks to absorb losses from risky assets like loans and securities. Regulators require certain capital levels to protect depositors, while equity investors seek an optimal balance that's high enough to support growth and satisfy regulators, yet low enough to allow adequate returns. From an investor's perspective, capital levels should ideally be the minimum allowed by regulation during normal times, with some excess during stress periods to avoid dilutive capital raises. Around 9% tangible common equity to tangible assets was considered baseline for pre-COVID conditions. Smaller banks generally maintain higher capital ratios due to faster growth and less diversification benefits. Post-global financial crisis, some advocate for higher bank capital requirements to reduce system fragility. However, simply forcing higher capital levels isn't a panacea for preventing financial crises. Excessive capital requirements without proper risk management could lead to perverse outcomes, such as banks moving assets off balance sheet, increasing overall risk while making analysis more difficult. Capital measurement approaches vary among regulators, ratings agencies, and investors. While investors primarily focus on TCE/TA, understanding regulatory capital ratios is crucial as they shape bank behavior and growth prospects. The regulatory capital structure consists of total capital, which includes Tier 1 capital, Common Equity Tier 1 plus additional Tier 1, and Tier 2 capital. When a bank trades at a price-to-tangible book value, P/TBV, below 1.0, for example 0.8x, it indicates the market expects future losses. For a hypothetical Bank A with 4B market cap, 5B tangible common equity, and $40 billion in loans trading at 0.8x P/TBV, we can calculate the implied losses. The $1 billion difference between TCE and market cap, adjusted to 1.3B pre-tax at 22% tax rate, plus the expected 3-year cumulative pre-provision net revenue of $2.3 billion, suggests the market anticipates cumulative net charge-offs of $3.6 billion, an implied loss rate of 9%. Risk weighting adjusts asset categories based on perceived riskiness to calculate regulatory capital metrics. Assets are multiplied by risk percentages from Basel III and aggregated to determine total risk-weighted assets. Lower risk weightings improve capital ratios. For example, Treasury securities have 0% risk weighting, deemed virtually riskless, while past due loans carry 150% risk weighting. Net tangible asset value provides a solid valuation baseline for bank stocks, with premiums or discounts reflecting numerous qualitative and quantitative factors. Key drivers include deposit-based quality, particularly the proportion of non-interest-bearing deposits, and their stability over rate cycles. Specialized lending niches such as equipment finance or SBA lending can command higher valuations due to their superior margins and barriers to entry. ROE performance, especially consistency across cycles, significantly impacts valuation multiples. Demographic trends in a bank's footprint, like population growth and household income levels, affect long-term growth potential. Customer loyalty, measured through metrics like account tenure and products per household, indicates franchise stability. Fee revenue diversity, particularly wealth management and treasury services, reduces reliance on spread income. M&A scarcity value becomes relevant in markets with few remaining acquisition targets. Management quality can be assessed through track record of capital allocation and risk management decisions. PTBV's relationship with ROE is fundamental to bank valuation theory. The premium to book value mathematically represents the present value of future excess returns above the cost of equity capital. Using the Gordon discount model, we can derive that PTBV equals ROE minus G over K minus G, where G is the growth rate and K is the cost of equity. This suggests a linear relationship between PTBV and ROTCE, return on tangible common equity. However, empirical analysis of over 600 publicly traded community and regional banks reveals that banks earning above average returns, 15% ROTCE, actually exhibit an exponential relationship, suggesting the market assigns additional value to sustained high performance. Capital adequacy regulations, including Basel III requirements and stress testing frameworks, provide benchmarks for appropriate leverage levels. For banks holding excess capital above regulatory requirements, a two-stage valuation approach is warranted. The core operating capital receives market multiples reflecting the underlying business quality, while excess capital receives a lower multiple closer to liquidation value. This approach prevents overcapitalized banks from appearing artificially cheap on PTBV metrics. Price-to-earnings analysis requires careful consideration of several factors. Forward estimates should be independently developed rather than accepting consensus figures, incorporating detailed analysis of loan growth, margin trends, and expense initiatives. Diluted EPS accounts for potential share issuance from options and convertible securities. Growth assumptions warrant particular scrutiny. Sustainable earnings growth typically ranges from 4 to 8% for mature banks without acquisition impact. Higher growth projections should be supported by specific catalysts like market share gains or efficiency improvements. During economic downturns, when credit costs spike and earnings become depressed or negative, PE ratios lose relevance. Price to PPNR provides a more stable valuation metric by excluding volatile loan loss provisions. PPNR focuses on core banking profitability through net interest income, fees, and operating expenses. Historical analysis shows PPNR multiples typically range from 5 to 8x for regional banks, with higher multiples justified for banks with superior efficiency ratios and fee income mix. Core deposit premium analysis has gained importance in the current rate environment. This metric, calculated as market cap minus TCE over core deposits, typically ranges from 5 to 15% for traditional banks. Premium levels correlate strongly with deposit composition, higher non-interest-bearing mix commanding higher premiums, and deposit beta history. Banks with proven ability to maintain low deposit costs through rate cycles, often through strong retail franchises or specialized commercial relationships, justify higher core deposit premiums. This becomes particularly relevant during monetary tightening cycles when funding cost advantages translate directly to margin preservation. Regulations have historically served as a cornerstone for maintaining safety and soundness in the banking system, instilling necessary discipline within financial institutions. However, the increasing regulatory complexity, particularly evident in European banking markets, has created operational challenges and sometimes counterproductive outcomes. The current regulatory framework encompasses multiple layers of oversight, thousands of pages of code requirements, and compliance costs that can reach millions of dollars annually for mid-sized banks. Guardrails and pragmatic regulations serve several critical functions in ensuring banking system stability. They establish risk management protocols, reduce pro-cyclical behavior during economic cycles, and implement sophisticated early warning systems to identify potential threats. These measures proved particularly valuable during the 2008 financial crisis and subsequent economic challenges. The U.S. regulatory framework operates through four main federal prudential regulators, each with distinct responsibilities. The Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, OCC, oversees national banks and federal thrifts, maintaining standards for capital adequacy and operational risk. The Federal Reserve supervises state-chartered member banks and holding companies, focusing on monetary policy implications. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, FDIC, monitors state-chartered non-member banks and manages the critical deposit insurance system. And the National Credit Union Administration, NCUA, provides oversight for federal credit unions. The FDIC, established during the Great Depression in 1933, has maintained an unblemished record of protecting depositors from losses on insured deposits. The current coverage extends to $250,000 per depositor, per insured bank, across various account categories, including checking accounts, savings accounts, money market deposit accounts, and certificates of deposit. When bank failures occur, the FDIC employs two primary resolution methods: arranging purchase and assumption, P&A transactions, where healthy banks acquire failed institutions, or directly paying depositors their insured balances through a deposit payoff. The CAMELS rating system serves as the primary tool for regulators to evaluate bank health and stability. This comprehensive assessment examines six critical areas: capital adequacy, measuring financial strength; asset quality, evaluating loan portfolio health; management capability, assessing leadership and governance; earnings quantity and quality, analyzing profitability and sustainability; liquidity adequacy, measuring ability to meet obligations; and sensitivity to market risk, evaluating vulnerability to market changes. Banks receive numerical ratings from 1 to 5 on each component, with 1 representing the strongest performance. The weighted composite score places particular emphasis on management capability, recognizing its crucial role in institutional stability. Banks receiving ratings of 4 or 5 face increased regulatory scrutiny on the problem bank list, while institutions rated 3 or higher must develop and implement specific action plans to address identified deficiencies. The $10 billion asset threshold represents a significant regulatory demarcation point, triggering enhanced oversight requirements and financial implications. Banks crossing this threshold, calculated based on a four-quarter average, must implement comprehensive stress testing programs and comply with the Durbin Amendment's restrictions on debit card interchange fees. The Durbin Amendment caps these fees at 21 cents plus 0.05% of the transaction value, with an additional 1 cent allowance for fraud prevention measures. These regulatory changes can significantly impact profitability, leading many banks approaching this threshold through mergers and acquisitions to strategically plan for substantially exceeding it, typically aiming for $12 to $15 billion in assets to achieve sufficient scale economies to offset the increased regulatory burden and revenue restrictions. Interest rates are fundamentally important when assessing banks. Unlike other companies where rates only affect financing costs, for banks, they impact both expenses and revenues, as rates form the underlying benchmark for pricing all credit instruments. Debt instruments are typically priced by layering risk premiums over a risk-free rate, with additional spreads based on credit quality, term structure, and market conditions. For example, a commercial loan might be priced at LIBOR plus 200-300 basis points, while a mortgage could be priced relative to the 10-year Treasury yield plus a spread. While intuitively higher rates should benefit banks as lenders, the empirical data shows this isn't a simple relationship. Bank stocks in the S&P 500 exhibit surprisingly low correlation with both short- and long-term interest rates, typically showing correlation coefficients below 0.3. Compared to other sectors, financials and banks specifically show minimal correlation with Fed funds rates and 10-year yields. This lack of correlation persists even when excluding recession periods, presenting opportunities for active investors to select specific banks that will outperform given certain interest rate expectations. For instance, during the 2004-2006 tightening cycle, regional banks showed widely divergent performance despite facing the same rate environment. The relationship between interest rates and bank profitability is complex and multifaceted. While yields on earning assets and funding costs are both highly correlated to interest rates, these sensitivities offset each other in ways that vary across institutions. As rates rise, both asset yields and funding costs increase, resulting in minimal sensitivity of net interest margins, pre-tax ROA, and RO to rate changes. Historical analysis shows that the largest shocks to profitability are credit quality related rather than interest rate driven, as evidenced by the savings and loan crisis of the 1980s and the 2008 financial crisis. Commercially oriented banks tend to be more asset sensitive because their shorter-term loan books, predominantly commercial and industrial and commercial real estate loans, are benchmarked to short-term rates like LIBOR or Prime, allowing them to reprice much quicker. Analysis of interest rate risk disclosures from 141 publicly traded banks confirms this relationship. Higher C&I exposure correlates directly with greater asset sensitivity. For example, banks with C&I loans exceeding 30% of assets typically show asset sensitivity measures 20-30% higher than their retail-focused peers. The most valuable deposit franchise is both low cost and stable, though these qualities often conflict in practice. Deposit stability encompasses both predictable flows and stable costs, measured by deposit betas, the change in costs for a given change in rates. Business demand deposit accounts offer zero cost and zero beta, but can experience large outflows during rate hiking cycles or economic stress. While certificates of deposit provide stable pricing and flows, but are highly price competitive and sensitive to market rates when rolling over. Analysis shows that core deposit franchises with betas below 0.3 typically command premium valuations of 2 to 3x book value, reflecting their enduring competitive advantage. Banks are primarily sold rather than bought, with qualitative factors playing a crucial role. These include CEO and board age and tenure, succession planning, shareholder base composition, particularly insider ownership and activist presence, change of control provisions and proxy filings, management's historical willingness to sell, and social factors like trust in the buyer's currency, shared interests, and cultural compatibility. Acquisition consideration can be stock, cash, or a combination. An acquirer's stock is often called its currency, with price to tangible book value being the key metric. Cash deals typically cause more tangible book value dilution, especially when an acquirer with premium valued stock doesn't use it, but they offer higher EPS accretion due to avoiding share issuance. Synergies represent the value created by combining two institutions. Cost synergies, the easiest to evaluate, are typically measured as a percentage of the target's expense base. These can come from branch overlap, management consolidation, back office elimination, and technology vendor consolidation. In-market deals with significant branch overlap may achieve over 50% cost savings, while high cost save assumptions for out-of-market acquisitions deserve scrutiny. Bank investors closely monitor tangible book value dilution from acquisitions, particularly on a per-share basis. Higher cash consideration and higher P/TBV premiums typically create more TBV dilution. Earnback represents the time needed to recover this dilution, with three calculation methods offering different perspectives. While 3 years or less is preferable, compelling strategic deals may justify longer earnback periods. Beyond financial metrics, strategic factors significantly impact acquirer stock reactions. These include balancing asset sensitivity, diversifying loan portfolios to reduce concentration risk, and combining complementary business models, such as urban lending franchises with healthy loan demand paired with low-cost rural deposit franchises. These strategic benefits often create value beyond what's immediately reflected in pro forma financials. When evaluating capital deployment, banks must compare the relative benefits of acquisitions versus stock buybacks. Both strategies can leverage a bank's balance sheet, but have different risk-reward profiles. When a bank's stock trades near tangible book value, buybacks become relatively more attractive. Additionally, buybacks carry significantly lower execution risk, making them an increasingly compelling option for capital return when acquisition premiums are high.